Searchable is Amherst's first venture in e-publication. The project was designed in close collaboration with the library at Amherst, and we're grateful to them, and to Erin Lurie in particular, for all their patient help. While on the subject of thanks, I'd like to express our gratitude to many in public affairs, especially Stacy Schmeidel, to Dee Brace in the philosophy department, and to the Forey and Micken Fund in philosophy and science for its generous support. Both the department and the library are very excited by this new venture, and we're hopeful that these lectures will prove to be stimulating moments in the life of the college, and that their online publication will prove to be a stimulus to philosophical conversation more broadly. Now I'd like to turn to Professor Nishi Shaw, who will introduce our speaker today.
It's my pleasure to introduce my good friend and former dissertation advisor, David Bellman. David's an alum of Amherst, class of 1974. He received his PhD in philosophy from Princeton University in 1983. He spent most of his career at the University of Michigan, just recently leaving for NYU. Along with performing the minor miracle of getting me to finish my dissertation, he's also made a number of important contributions to philosophy. His first collection of papers, The Possibility of Practical Reason, represents his work in the philosophy of action. Many of these papers have already become classics in the field. The second collection of papers, which has just come out, called Self to Self, displays David's breadth, the breadth of issues that he's worked on. In this collection, he gives accounts of the nature of personal identity, autonomy, and moral emotions such as guilt, shame, and love, along with a distinctive interpretation of Kant's ethical theory. It's always quite exciting for me to pick up a new paper from David because, I never know what to expect. Except that I'll be led to think about an issue, an important philosophical issue, in a way that I never could have on my own. And I'm sure today's paper, So It Goes, will be no exception. Please join me in welcoming David Bellman.
Well, thank you very much, Alex and Nishi, and thanks to the philosophy department for... There we are. Okay. For inviting me, it really is a great honor to be invited to give this first lecture in the series, and as always, it's a pleasure to be at Amherst. I owe a tremendous amount to my Amherst teachers, one of whom is here, Rick Griffiths, but I'm not sure any of the others are here. So I'm very pleased to be here. What I want to talk about, oops, this is going backwards, why is that? Here we go. What I want to think about today is the Buddhist doctrine that the illusion of an enduring self is the source of the suffering that is endemic to human life. Now, I am not a practicing Buddhist, and I am not a scholar of Buddhism, and this lecture is not an exercise in Buddhist studies. What I'm interested in is whether just this thought, that the illusion of an enduring self is the source of suffering, can be made sense of in the context of contemporary philosophy about personal identity. One of my reasons for being interested in this thought is that there are many contemporary philosophers who say things about the self that sound something like Buddhist doctrine. They say that the self is something that we construct or invent or imagine or even hallucinate. And these are the sorts of things that the Buddhists sometimes say. However, most of the contemporary Western philosophers who say this tend to think that our constructing or inventing or imagining a self for ourselves is a wonderful accomplishment that we should be very pleased about. Whereas The Buddhists say the self is something that we construct or invent or imagine, and it's a big mistake. You've got to learn to stop doing that. And I'm interested in the difference of opinion there. And again, in how we can make sense of that difference of opinion within the context of Western contemporary philosophy about the self. Now, the one Western philosopher who has said things similar to the Buddhist doctrine is Derek Parfit. He, too, denies the existence of an enduring self. And Parfit, unlike the other philosophers to whom I've alluded, and I guess for the philosophy students I should say, I'm thinking of Christine Korsgaard or Daniel Dennett or Harry Frankfurt. Parfit, unlike those other philosophers, does say that dispelling the illusion of having an enduring self yields certain consolations. And in that respect, Parfit seems to suggest that he sees the belief in an enduring self as a source of trouble of some kind. So I want to start by looking at a few passages in which Parfit describes the consolations he thinks that that are to be derived from giving up the belief in an enduring self. So here is one passage in which he talks about it. He speaks about the time before he realized that there was no enduring self. And he says, at that time, my life seemed like a glass tunnel through which I was moving faster every year and at the end of which there was darkness. When I changed my view, the walls of my glass tunnel disappeared. I now live in the open air. And the other passage in which Parfit says something similar is this. He says, egoism, the fear not of near but of distant death, the regret that so much of one's only life should have gone by, these are not, I think, wholly natural or instinctive. They are all strengthened by the beliefs about personal identity which I have been attacking, that is, beliefs in an enduring self. If we give up these beliefs, they should be weakened. So I'm interested in figuring out something about how consolations of this sort can be derived from giving up belief in an enduring self. And one of the questions I want to ask is how similar Parfit's views can be to the Buddhist views. One major difference between them is Parfit simply gives us philosophical arguments against the proposition that we have enduring selves, or that we are enduring selves. These arguments are contained in a book called Reasons and Persons, and you read that book, you've read the arguments, you're supposed to derive the consolations. But in Buddhism, really, the consolation, the full value of the consolations from dispelling the illusion of the enduring self are meant to come from long and arduous meditative practice, not simply from reading a single book. And so a question in my mind is whether Parfit and the Buddhists could really be talking about the same thing, whether they could be talking about the same consolations. If they were, why do the Buddhists think that this arduous meditative practice is necessary? So, to start out then, let me say something about what I mean by an enduring self and what it is to deny that we have enduring selves. I'm going to be using the term endure, endurance, and enduring in a technical sense used by metaphysicians in which it refers to a particular view about how objects persist. The generic term is persistence. Objects that last through time are said to persist. And there are supposed to be two metaphysical views about how objects persist, how we are to conceive of their persistence through time. One of these views goes by the name of perdurance, to be contrasted with endurance. And the concept of perdurance is this, that a perduring object is extended in time the way material objects are extended in space. Specifically, an object is extended in space by having different parts that occupy different points in space. So part of me is over here, and part of me is over there, and so on. I am extended in space by having different parts at different points. Similarly, a perduring object is thought to be extended in time by having different parts at different points in time. Not spatial parts, of course, temporal parts. So the object is conceived then as being a four-dimensional object, extended not only in three spatial dimensions, but in the temporal dimension, and as having parts in that temporal dimension in the same sense as in the spatial dimensions. An enduring object then is, in contrast to a perduring object, thought to be wholly present at every moment of its existence. Not just part of it, all of it. Now, it's not entirely clear what that means, and I will come back to that question in a moment. But first, let me say a little bit more about perdurance, and in particular, what it would be to have a perduring rather than enduring self. If I am a perduring object, then what you see now is just a small part of me. You are, in the course of the next 2 hours, going to see 2 hours worth of me. But there is, behind me, in time, a whole 53 years worth of me that you never got to see. He got to see some of it, but the rest of you never saw it. Okay? You can see the same person, me, on different days, only in the sense in which you see the same body sticking out of my two sleeves. What you are actually seeing here is one part of that body and another part of that body sticking out of my different sleeves. They are the same body because they are two parts of the same body. And they're two parts of the same body because they are connected inside my clothes. Similarly, on two successive days, you would see two temporal parts of me, which are two temporal parts of the same person because of being connected. Also connected out of your sight, since you wouldn't have seen me in the intervening time. For that reason, then, I now am a different part of the same person as I at another time. I was in this room 35 years ago as an Amherst student. But what was in this room 35 years ago was another part of me. And we are parts of the same person, only in the sense that we are connected in the right way. That person of 35 years ago and me now are connected in the right way to be parts of the same person. So that's the idea of being a perduring object. Let's look now at what it really means to be an enduring object. What does it mean to say that rather than having different parts at different times, I am wholly present at every moment of my existence? Well, the word wholly in this expression can't just mean in all of my spatial parts. Of course, all of my spatial parts are present at every moment of my existence, but that's true of a perduring object as well. The concept of perdurance is not that I have spatial parts that aren't here now, it's that I have temporal parts that aren't here now. So can wholly present mean that all of my temporal parts are here now? Well, my 18-year-old self, who was here all those years ago, is not here now. So how could one claim that all of my temporal parts are here now? It seems as if what the endurance concept must be is that I don't have spatial parts. I can't be divided into spatial parts. And yet, sorry, I don't have temporal parts. I can't be divided into temporal parts. And yet, it seems odd to claim that something that is extended in time can't be divided into temporal parts. Time is a dimension. That dimension is divisible into periods and smaller periods. And if I am extended in time, it would seem as if we can consider me insofar as I am in one of those smaller periods. And that would be a temporal part of me. So how could we deny that I, if I persist, have temporal parts? So it's rather unclear what the concept of enduring, as opposed to perduring, really is. It's not clear that a coherent concept of endurance can be defined. But that doesn't matter for my purposes. And the reason it doesn't matter for my purposes is I think we have an incoherent concept of endurance, and in particular that we get this incoherent concept of endurance precisely from thinking about the self. So I want to say something about where I think the concept of endurance comes from and how it applies to the self. I think it comes from the structure of our experience of time, in particular the structure of memory and anticipation. So when I remember a past experience, I remember the world is experienced from the perspective of a past self. My memory has an egocentric representational scheme centered on the person who originally had the experience from which the memory is derived. That person's standpoint lies at a spatio-temporal distance from the present standpoint that I occupy while entertaining the memory. But the mind is not especially scrupulous about the distinction between the subjects occupying these distinct points of view. Remembering a past experience, I tend to feel that I am, as we say, reliving it, that I am back there again, while also occupying the here and now. In fact, I'm not back there again in the remembered experience. I'm right here, remembering it now. But the structure of memory leads me to conflate my remembering self with the self of the experience remembered. I who remember the experience and the I of the experience become superimposed, so that a single self appears to be present in both. The selves superimposed in this appearance are two momentary subjects. I in my present capacity is the subject of memory, existing just in the moment of remembering, and the I of the remembered experience, who existed just in the moment of the experience. In either case, I am conceived as wholly present at a single point as in time, either as me here and now, entertaining the memory, a self that exists just at this moment, or as me there and then, having the experience, a self that existed just at that moment. Superimposing one of these momentary subjects on the other yields the illusion that they are numerically identical, that the subject whose existence is complete in the moment of remembering is one and the same as the subject whose existence was complete in the moment of the experience remembered. This appearance is already incoherent if one and the same momentary thing cannot exist at two different moments. But the incoherence is compounded by the thought that this momentary subject has persisted through the interval between the original experience and the memory, existing in its entirety at each intervening moment. The same effect is produced by experiential anticipation, in which I prefigure a future experience from the perspective that I expect to occupy in it. A single self appears to have its complete existence both now and later, because I who anticipate the experience and the I of the anticipated experience become superimposed. for a spatial analog of the resulting idea. Think of the scene in which Woody Allen plays a spermatozoon about to be launched from the loins of Woody Allen. This is in the movie Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sex But You're Afraid to Ask. In reality, of course, a person occupies different points in space with different parts, none of which is identical to any other part or to the person as a whole. We might say, then, that a person pervades space, on analogy with perduring through time. In this sense, however, Woody Allen occupies different points in space. Sorry, in this scene, however, Woody Allen occupies different points in space with a smaller self that plays the role of each spatial part of his own body. We might say then that he invades space rather than pervading it. Incoherent to say the least. Yet experiential memory leads me to think that my own temporal extension is composed of a momentary self playing the role of each temporal part of my existence. There I am, fully and completely myself at my fifth birthday party. Here I am, fully and completely myself, remembering that party 47 years later. There I will be, fully and completely myself, on my 75th birthday party. Yet I am also the temporally extended object of which this momentary subject serves as each successive temporal part. On the analogy of Woody Allen being little Woody Allens in each cell of his body, making up a big Woody Allen. I'm tempted to say that all of my temporal parts are present at a single point in time because I tend to think of myself as my present self, a momentary subject whose existence is indeed complete in the here and now. I'm tempted to say that I nevertheless persist through time because I tend to think of this self, complete in the moment, as nevertheless existing at other moments. Because I therefore conceive of each moment in my temporal extension as containing my complete self, I'm tempted to deny that it contains a mere temporal part of me. I think of myself as all of me all the time, just as Woody Allen is all Woody Allen in every one of his selves. Okay, so the idea is that's what it would be to be an enduring object. And in fact, that's how I think of myself, even though it is an incoherent way to think of myself. Now, I want to now make a claim, state a hypothesis. And that is that this conception of myself as enduring in this sense lies at the bottom of our perception of time. And so in order to explain this, I'm going to need to make a brief digression into the philosophy of time. So set the self to one side for a minute, and now just let's think about time. We'll start with a view of time called eternalism. It has various names. I'll use the name eternalism. On this view, all of the facts that there are about time have one of two forms. They're either facts about what is earlier or later than what, or they are facts about what is further apart or closer than what in time. So the idea is, once you have placed all events in relation to one another as earlier or later than one another, and as closer or further apart from one another in time, once you have stated all those facts, you have stated all the facts there are about time. There's nothing else to say. The world is a manifold of events, if you like, laid out in space and time. Say how they're related, earlier and later, further apart and closer, and that's all there is to it. Now, there has traditionally been, especially since a famous article published by the philosopher J. Ellis McTaggart, an objection to this view of time. And the objection is that it leaves something out. It seems to leave out any movement or flow or change. Events are related to one another as earlier and later, closer and nearer. But they're laid out in that array of relations timelessly. Two events If one is earlier than the other, it always was earlier, always will be earlier. It's timelessly earlier. Events are fixed in these relations to one another, and nothing changes. So one way of looking at it then is, on this view, the future doesn't draw nearer, and the past doesn't recede. I can say midnight is getting closer and closer and closer. And what I just said will be true. But let's look at what makes it true on the eternalist view. On the eternalist view, what makes it true is that when I said the third closer in that sentence, my third utterance of the word closer, midnight was closer to that utterance than it was to my second utterance of the word closer. And it was closer to my second utterance of the word closer than it was to the first. I said the word closer three times. The third one was closer to midnight than the second, which was closer than the first. But those relations between those three utterances and the stroke of midnight, those relations are the same for all time, are timelessly the same. Nothing changes. Midnight always has been, always will be, timelessly is, closer to that third utterance than it was to the first. So nothing moves, nothing changes. These events are just fixed, like in amber. Time doesn't seem to flow. You might think, well, the future draws closer to the present, that's it. That's what's moving. Actually, it's the present that's moving into the future. But in fact, on the eternalist view, and it seems reasonable to say, there is no... The word present is not the name of a particular time. Present is a status, if you like, that each moment has in its turn. Each moment gets to be the present moment for one moment. And this happens in time. Each moment gets to be the present moment at that moment. Present is the relation that each moment bears to itself. It's the status that each moment has during that moment. So, and in that sense, it's true of all moments. Has always been true, always will be true, is timelessly true, that each moment is present in relation to itself. And it is also true that the future is closer to some of those self-present moments than to others. But again, those relations are fixed for all time. Nothing seems to move. The future doesn't draw closer, the present doesn't move forward, the past does not recede. All right. That's the problem with the eternalist view of time. There are various ways of trying to identify the fact about time that eternalism leaves out. How can we say what it is about time that is left out of this picture? But it turns out to be extremely difficult to say it, for the reasons that I've given here, that almost anything you can say about time can be translated into the eternalist picture in which nothing seems to move, including my slide. There. So, how are we going to explain what we mean when we say that time passes? It looks as if what we need is something that stands still in time. The problem in describing what we mean when we say time passes is that whenever we try to describe it, we end up saying, well, time passes in time. Time passes from one moment to the next. And then it turns out that the future ends up just being closer to some moments than it is to others, which can be captured in the eternalist picture in which nothing moves. We need something to stand still so that the future can draw closer to it and the past can recede from it. We need something to stand still so different moments can be present to it rather than each being present to itself. What I want to suggest is that the thing that stands still in time, in relation to which time flows or passes, is the enduring self. If there is an enduring self, the future can draw closer to it, the past can recede from it, and different moments can be present to it. So let me explain a little bit further what I mean by that. Suppose that I endure, in the admittedly incoherent sense that is suggested by experiential memory and anticipation. In that case, I exist in my entirety at successive moments in time, thereby moving in my entirety with respect to events. As I move through time, future events draw nearer to me, and past events recede. Time truly passes in the sense that it passes me. If I merely perdure, however, then I do not move with respect to time. I extend through time with newer and newer temporal parts, but all of my parts remain stationary. A perduring self can be compared to a process, such as the performance of a symphony. The performance seems to flow past us, the listeners, but it seems to flow past us because we think of ourselves as enduring objects, hearing one note after another while retaining our identities complete and unchanged from one note to the next. The performance doesn't move with respect to time, however. It merely extends newer and newer temporal parts to fill each successive moment. The last note of the performance is, of course, closer to midnight than the first. But we wouldn't say that midnight and the performance move closer together. Midnight and the performance are separated by a timelessly fixed but extremely vague interval, which can be made precise only with respect to particular parts of the performance. The first note, the second note, the third note, each of which is separated from midnight by an interval that is also timelessly fixed. Similarly, we wouldn't say that the ceiling and I get closer together from my feet to my head. The ceiling stands above me at a fixed but vague distance, which can be made precise only with respect to particular parts of me, my feet, my waist, my head, each of which is separated from it by a fixed distance. But if I am an enduring thing, then midnight and I get closer together, and not just in the sense that I extend temporal parts closer to it than my earlier parts. It's not just that I extend from a 9 p.m. stage to a 10 p.m. stage that is closer to midnight, as I extend from my feet to a head that is closer to the ceiling. I exist in my entirety within the stroke of 9, and I exist again within the stroke of 10, the self-same entity twice, existing once further from midnight and then all over again closer. Hence, I don't just extend toward midnight as I extend toward the ceiling. Midnight occupies two different distances from my fully constituted self. From my perspective, then, midnight draws nearer. Hume notoriously committed the fallacy of equating a succession of impressions with an impression of succession. That is, he thought that hearing one note and then hearing another note amounted to hearing not just the two notes, but also the relation later than holding between them. Hume was wrong because representations that succeed one another in time don't thereby represent anything as succeeding in time. And so they don't represent temporal succession. An impression of succession would require that the experience of hearing the second note be accompanied, for example, by a memory of hearing the first or an anticipation of hearing the third, the former representing the past note as past, the latter representing the future note as future. We would commit a similar fallacy, analogous to Hume's, if we thought that this experience of succession, or even a succession of such experiences, would amount to an experience of the passage of time. Imagine an experience of a first note as past, a second as present, and a third as future. So, do, re, mi. Here, the way I've represented it, I'm hearing re. In brackets, I'm remembering do. And in angle brackets, I'm anticipating or expecting me. Yes? And then at the next moment, I have the experience of hearing me, remembering re, and anticipating fa. Yes? And now I could have a succession of experiences of the notes. At each moment, hearing one note, remembering the previous note, anticipating the next. If each experience represented the notes as past, present, and future, from the perspective of that experience, then the two experiences would represent only the timeless relations of earlier and later between the notes and themselves. And the fact that one experience occurred after the other would not be sufficient to represent a passage between those perspectives. In order to represent the passage of time, these experiences would have to include me as occupying the one perspective and then occupying the other, the self-same me passing through different temporal positions. I would need to have an experience of the first note as heard by me, followed by a memory of its being heard by the same me who now remembers it at a further remove. Or I would need to anticipate the third note as heard by me who anticipates it, followed by the experience of its being heard by me who remembers having that anticipation. That would represent me as moving from the one perspective to the other. And then something would move. If this diachronically constant me is an illusion, however, then so is the passage of time. And ceasing to think of myself as an enduring subject should result in my ceasing to experience the passage of time. Coming to think of myself as perduring should result in my coming to experience different parts, temporal parts of myself at different moments, but no enduring self past whom these moments can flow. Suppose that I could learn to experience my successive moments of consciousness, now, and now, and now, as successive notes in a performance with no enduring listener, no self-identical subject for whom these moments would be now and then again. My present self, cognizant of being distinct from past and future parts of the same perduring person, would no longer think of itself as just having emerged from the past and just about to enter the future. It would regard some events as lying in its past or future, and it would conceive of these events as bearing different relations to its past and future selves. But it would have no conception of a single subject to which events could bear different relations over time, nothing to which they could draw near or from which they could recede. It would think of itself and each of its fellow temporal parts as seeing its own present moment, with none of them seeing a succession of moments as present. The result would be that time would no longer seem to pass, because my experience would no longer include a subject of its passage, just successive momentary subjects, each timelessly entrenched in its own temporal perspective. I would think of myself as filling time rather than as passing through it or having it pass me by, as existing in time the way a rooted plant exists in space, growing extensions to occupying it without moving in relation to it. Having shed the illusion of an enduring self, I would have lost any sense of time as passing at all. One small bit of evidence in support of this speculation is that when I lose awareness of myself, by losing myself in engrossing activities, I also tend to lose awareness of time's passing. With my attention fully devoted to playing a sport, reading a book, writing a paragraph, I'm drawn out of myself and, as it seems, out of the passage of time as well. Conversely, when I have nothing to occupy my attention, that is, when I'm bored, my attention returns to myself and the passage of time becomes salient. Self-awareness and time awareness thus seem to go hand in hand. Clearly, I'm nowhere near to losing myself in this way on a lasting basis, despite being convinced by arguments like the one I've given that I am in fact a perduring rather than an enduring self. Truly assimilating the implications of those arguments would entail radical changes in my experience, changes of the sort that no argument can produce. No wonder, then, that the Buddhists believe that dispelling the illusion of an enduring self requires an arduous regimen of meditation. So the idea is this. If I were to lose the illusion of being an enduring self who is strictly identical from one moment to the next, I would lose the illusion of time's passage. And now I want to explore a further hypothesis. My hypothesis is that the suffering that the Buddhists may be thinking of, or at least that it makes sense to think about, is suffering that comes from the passage of time. And that the reason why losing a sense of oneself as an enduring thing yields the alleviation of suffering is because it would end the sense of time's passing. So let's look again at the consolations that Parfit spoke about in the passages that I quoted at the beginning. There's something strange about these passages. And what's strange is the way that Parfit describes the consolations of his view. Parfit's arguments emphasize the fact that I now am not strictly identical with me at another time. That I now and I then are just different parts of a perduring self. And that we're just connected in certain ways, not strictly identical with one another. That's what Parfit has in mind in the first passage when he talks about the disappearance of the glass tunnel. The glass tunnel represents the enduring self, which is strictly identical to itself through time. And breaking apart the glass tunnel is breaking apart this notion of being strictly self-identical from one moment to the next, and substituting it with the notion of simply having different interconnected parts at different times. But if what Parfit is worried about is that, as he puts it, my one and only life is running out, it's not clear why he wants to break out of the glass tunnel. What makes it my life, after all, is that it is confined to this tunnel. That's what makes it mine. So why should that be a consolation? Clearly, what is bugging Parfit in the first passage is not that he's confined to this glass tunnel that defines the life as mine. What's bugging Parfit is that he's moving through it and approaching the end of it. What's bugging him is the passage of time, not the tunnel. And so really, Parfit hasn't quite put his finger on where the consolations lie. Is there feedback from one of these? Can someone? Okay. So now I'd like to talk about another description of the consolations that I have in mind from giving up the sense. Or dispelling the sense of the passage of time. And these are described in Kurt Vonnegut's novel, Slaughterhouse-Five, which is the source of the title of the talk. Slaughterhouse. I'm told that undergraduates no longer all read Slaughterhouse-Five. Is that true? It would be a terrible shame if it were true. So I'm going to read some of these passages to you. You'll have to bear with me. The book begins, Billy Pilgrim has come unstuck in time. Billy has gone to sleep, a senile widower, and awakened on his wedding day. He has walked through a door in 1955 and come out another in 1941. He has seen his birth and death many times, he says, and pays random visits to all the events in between. Billy is spastic in time, has no control over where he is going next, and the trips aren't necessarily fun. He is in a constant state of stage fright, he says, because he never knows what part of his life he is going to have to act in next. Now, Billy has gotten into this spastic state, coming unstuck in time, as a result of having visited the planet Tralfamador. He was abducted by the Tralfamadorians and brought to their home planet to be displayed as an intergalactic zoological specimen. And the Tralfamadorians have an even more radical relation to time than Billy ends up with. The Tralfamadorians can look at different moments just the way we can look at a stretch of the Rocky Mountains, for instance. They can see how permanent all the moments are, and they can look at any moment that interests them. So in other words, for the Tralfamadorians, time does not pass. Time is arrayed in all its relations of earlier and later, the way the Rocky Mountains are arrayed in front of us in relations of left to right. And for that reason, the Tralfamadorians have a very different attitude to life from ours. And this is the attitude that Billy learned from them. When a person dies, he only appears to die. He is still very much alive in the past. So it's very silly for people to cry at his funeral. All moments, past, present, and future, always have existed, always will exist. It is just an illusion that one moment follows another one like beads on a string, and that once a moment is gone forever. In other words, it's an illusion that time passes, say the Tralfamadorians. And for that reason, the Tralfamadorians have derived certain consolations from not having to experience the passage of time. When a Tralfamadorian sees a corpse, all he thinks is that the dead person is in a bad condition at that particular moment, but that the same person is just fine in plenty of other moments. Now, when I myself, says Billy, hear that somebody is dead, I simply shrug and say what the Tralfamadorians say about dead people, which is, so it goes. Okay. Now, there is something a little bit strange going on here. The Tralfamadorians have not quite escaped from the passage of time. Billy certainly has not escaped from the passage of time, and here is why. It's true that he is unstuck in time as we know it, because he jumps from 1955 to 1941 to 1960. But notice, he first visits 1955. Then he visits 1941. Then he visits 1960. These visits occur in a kind of meta-time that still seems to flow, because he still finds himself shoved into another time and another visit bearing down on him. That's his sense of stage fright, that another visit to another moment is coming up any moment. So Billy is in a kind of meta-time in which he jumps around in our temporal order. And in fact, it sounds as if the Tralfamadorians do the same thing. That is, they can control which part of time they look at, but they control it in time. They look at one part, and then another part, and then a third part. So this is not quite what we're looking for when we talk about getting rid of the sense of the passage of time. But it gives a sort of flavor of the consolations that I'm thinking of when I say that losing the sense of the passage of time would dispel certain kinds of suffering. So now let's look at the consolations. Having looked at Parfit's consolations and Billy's consolations, Billy Pilgrim's consolations, I want to look at least one description from the secondary literature of the consolations that the Buddhists take themselves to have to derive from losing the illusion of having an enduring self. The description goes like this. Man is in this predicament of suffering, the word dukkha is the word for suffering, because of his attachment to a false notion of the self conceived as a permanent entity. In this predicament in which man is threatened by the possibility of non-being, he seeks for some security and imagines that he has an immortal soul on which he can depend. But he cannot escape the fact that decay is inherent in all things. This fact comes into conflict with his imaginary notion of the self. This conflict is the cause of suffering. It is the state of existential anxiety. And the solution to the problem consists in dispelling the false notion of the self. When it is seen that decay is inherent even in the so-called self, when one realizes that even the so-called self is impermanent, the conflict ceases and the suffering comes to an end. Now, I think we can understand what this passage is saying, and I don't want to suggest that it doesn't make sense. But it does raise a kind of puzzlement, I think. And that is, it seems to say that the cause of our suffering is anxiety about impermanence. And the solution to our suffering is to realize just how impermanent we are. Now, you might wonder why, if what we're worried about is being impermanent, we should feel any better from coming to realize that we're even less permanent than we thought. Now, I think the idea is something like this. The anxiety in the face of impermanence results from our hoping for a kind of permanence. It's the disappointment or the anxiety about the disappointment of this hope that is the source of suffering. And that if we truly understand that impermanence is unavoidable, we will give up our aspiration or hope of permanence, and the suffering will go away. In a sense, the hunger for permanence can be starved out in some way once we realize that impermanence truly is that permanence truly is impossible. But I think that there's another way to think about this. If we give up the notion of the enduring self, and if, as a result of that, we can dispel the illusion of the passage of time, we will have a different concept of permanence and impermanence. In the eternalist view of time, in which nothing moves and time doesn't pass, what is permanence? Permanence is being everywhere in time, being temporally ubiquitous, existing at all moments. Now, when you describe permanence that way, when you describe permanence that way as being everywhere in time, it doesn't sound particularly attractive. And when you describe impermanence as being only in part of time, and not in all of it, it doesn't sound that bad. The problem with impermanence is the sense that time is running out. And that comes not from the impermanence, it comes from the passage of time for someone who will last for only an impermanent term, and for whom, if time passes or runs, it can then run out. Okay, so that's the main idea. I want to finish by thinking about one further thing. And the way I want to introduce this thought is by asking why the Tralfamadorians say so it goes. In a way, having heard the description of the Tralfamadorian view of time, you might think, well, the Tralfamadorians shouldn't say so it goes because it doesn't go for them. Nothing goes. It is. What the Tralfamadorians should say is, so it is. So why do they say so it goes? Maybe what they mean is, so it goes, as I imagine it, is something they say to us. After all, they don't experience time as passing, but we do, And we can't stop experiencing time as passing. There's nothing we can do about it, except perhaps if we pursue a lifetime of meditational practice. And therefore, what we need is some kind of exportable lesson that we can take home from the planet Tralfamador to our planet where time seems to pass. And in that case, so it goes is something that it makes sense for us to say, knowing what we know about how things look to the Tralfamadorians. So it's an exportable lesson. And one of the things that interests me about Buddhism is that it needs exportable lessons too. Not because there's another planet involved, but because only a small number of people can fully grasp the truth about the nature of the world, namely the people who devote their lives to meditational practice, that is, the monks. And somebody has to feed the monks. And the people who feed the monks can't devote their lives to meditational practice. And so there has to be some exportable lesson that we can draw from what the monks see, but maybe we are unable to see. So I want to think finally about what the exportable lessons might be. I think that the exportable lessons here must include something about the way we cope with the passage of time. We can't stop the self from seeming to endure or stop time from seeming to pass. But we can cope with these phenomena better given the knowledge that they are mere appearances. Ordinarily, I cope rather badly with temporal passage and personal endurance. I don't exactly live in a Billy Pilgrim-esque state of stage fright, continually unsure when I might find myself at my fifth birthday party or my 75th. I'm more like a Tralfamadorian, because I can choose which parts of my life to visit in memory and anticipation. Yet I have a disconcerting tendency to live different parts of my life all at once, to relive the past and pre-live the future, even while I'm trying to live in the present. And even as I relive my past in a memory, it is at the same time speeding away from me, as there comes bearing down on me a future that I am pre-living in anticipation. It's as if too many parts of my life are on the table at once, and yet somehow they are continually being served up and snatched away, like dishes in a restaurant whose waitstaff is too impatient to let me eat. And this whole grief and anxiety-provoking conception of myself has been adopted to feed a kind of temporal gluttony, a desire to eat my birthday cake and have it too. Once I know that the self doesn't endure, then even when under the illusion to the contrary, I can better follow the Buddhist injunction to be fully aware of the present moment. The realization that I am of the moment, that is, a momentary part of a perduring self, can remind me to be in the moment, which draws my attention away from time's passage, even if it doesn't succeed in stopping time from seeming to pass. Insofar as I can be in the moment, I can perhaps gain some respite from the grief and anxiety of that overwhelmed diner on whom loaded plates are bearing down even as uneaten dishes are being borne away. Each moment can be devoted to savoring the dish of the moment. Thank you.
Okay, I'll call on the questions, and I'm going to try to get students first. So, if you're not a student and you have a question, just restrain yourself for a little bit.
Can we turn the projector off?
Jenny?
I got a little lost about your relation with the concept of enduring.
Yes.
Because you seem to be saying that it was incoherent because on the one hand, they're committed to there not being temporal parts, but of course there are temporal parts because everything extended to be divided into parts.
Yes.
What I didn't quite grasp was why they're committed to people being temporarily extended. And like the picture I've got is like you've got like a red dot moving along like a line. It's not extended, and you can say it moved and seem to get. Why can't they have a picture like that? That were three dimensional objects that are just sort of trapped in a fourth dimension, sort of pushed along. Do you see? Why are they committed?
Well, to if that? We're if your conception is that we're three dimensional objects, then what you mean is we're not extended in time.
Yeah.
We're momentary selves. And to think that in a way, that is the picture of the enduring self that I think we have. That I am a momentary me. I'm the me of now. And that this momentary me exists at different times. But that is to say that one and the same momentary object can exist at different moments. And that's the incoherence. That's the picture that's like the little Woody Allen existing in each spatial part of Woody Allen's body. If I'm a momentary object, then the me that exists at the stroke of noon can't be the same momentary object that exists at the stroke of one, because they're at two different moments. So they have to be two different momentary objects.
I'm sorry, I'm being a little dense, but
not at all.
If you have a point that's moving, couldn't we say that's the same point, even though it's at different? I mean, if you have like a red dot on a blue line,
yes,
it's at different like coordinates. But if we see it move the whole way, I don't know that my intuition at least is to say that's not the same point. So in the same way, can we have like a momentary person that just sort of moves through time? And like, I'm not. You do get into problems then if you talk about your past self or your future self, but if you really only use the present tense, is that necessarily an incoherent version?
Well, again, if you think of what you're imagining is that moving self makes up a persisting person. Yes, who lasts through time, right? And then the question is, why isn't that person as he exists at 1 o'clock, and that person is as he existed at noon, two different temporal parts of the same person? And why do you insist, how can you insist that they are one and the same momentary thing existing twice over at two different moments? That's the difficulty. In a way, to tell you the truth, in a way, I'm not. In a way, you have expressed the point of the paper, in a way. Because what you've said is, the way to get that dot to be the same is to have it move. Right? And that's exactly my point. The way to get a momentary self to exist at different points in time, the same over and over again, is for it to move in time. And that therefore, movement in time and endurance in the of the self are connected. So, in a sense, your intuition is the underlying point of the paper. There are other arguments that could be used to express why the self that exists at one moment is not strictly identical to the self that exists at another. These are arguments that are given by, for example, Parfit in his stuff on personal identity, and I didn't give that here. So if the mere challenge to the notion of endurance doesn't satisfy you, that would be the place to go. Yeah.
Daniel.
Hi. I guess I have a couple questions, but I guess one of the ways to phrase it would be: do you consider that the study of the philosophy of diachronic identity is the same thing as the study of the philosophy of identity? And the reason I ask that is because you know, for your argument, you went into the philosophy of time.
Yes.
But you didn't go into the philosophy, I think, of identity. I'm wondering...
Do you mean personal identity?
So, for example, when you say, you know, me at 18 and me at 25, are you conceiving of me as sort of a biological mechanistic model of the human being, sort of like a pre-Descartes, like an Aristotelian biological conception?
Yes.
Or are you considering sort of like that we have sort of some sort of soul? Because, I mean, and that's going to step into, you know, your view of time, I think, automatically, especially since people think that souls are sort of timeless. But I'm just wondering, why can't you be temporally here, your 18-year-old self? I mean, sort of the way I see it, it integrates into who you are, sort of your personality. So, yes, you're not here as you look when you're 18, but that's to borrow from your spatial conception of who you are anyway. You don't look the same as you are when you're 18, but maybe your 18-year-old self, 18-year-old self is within you right now, that temporal state. So I don't see why you didn't go into the philosophy of identity.
I didn't really for lack of time. And in a way, your question it relates to the earlier question. I tried to take a shortcut. And the shortcut I tried to take was instead of talking about the specific problems of personal identity, to talk about the problems of identity of things in general through time. And that is the issue of the perdurance conception and the endurance conception. And again, I tried to argue that there's a basic problem with the endurance conception. That so even if I have a soul, and even if the same soul that was here in 1974 is here again now, insofar as it is a persisting object, it is extended in time, and it is separable into temporal parts, and it is therefore subject to the statement that the temporal part of it that's here now is not the temporal part that was here then. I think of myself as having sort of cut across differences in how you might conceive of the person, whether you conceive of the person as a biological organism or a soul or a mind or whatever. We could discuss it the other way, but that would have taken me in a different direction.
If you agree that you can only experience things in the present.
Yes.
And there is no real passage of time. And how do you know that any other time exists, that the future exists, or the past exists at all? And because you can't have any real awareness of that, how would you actually have awareness of objects perduring, because you can't really conceive?
Well, the eternalist picture of time doesn't raise any questions about, for example, causation. First of all, in the eternalist picture of time, events happen, and some happen earlier and some happen later, and there are causal connections among them. And so, on that picture, the memories that I'm having now are traces of experiences had at previous moments. And my knowledge of the past can come through memory. And that's not a problem. The issue is simply whether there is more to time than the eternalist picture describes. That is, more than an array, or more than the Tralfamadorians describe. An array of moments spread out like the Rocky Mountains, some earlier, some later, and connected causally the way the Rocky Mountains are connected to each other. There are great problems about how we know about the past and how we know about the future. There's no question about that. But the idea that time doesn't pass is neutral on that. Doesn't make knowledge of the past and future any more difficult.
I was just wondering if, since coming to these conclusions, you personally experienced less suffering.
No. But that was part of the point of the paper. Part of the point of the paper was that, basically, that Parfit's way of going about it, the Western philosopher's way of going about it, giving philosophical arguments, doesn't solve the problem. Because just knowing the arguments and seeing the conclusion of the argument doesn't do it. And the reason it doesn't do it is that it, the real moral of the story, is something that you can't assimilate from an argument. Because merely from reading the argument, you can't stop time from seeming to pass. In order to stop time from seeming to pass, you've got to do more than just doing philosophy. You've got to start living differently. You've got to start being in the moment. And being in the moment is not the conclusion of a philosophical argument. So... and in a way, the last couple of pages of the paper were a piece of autobiography explaining how it doesn't matter what philosophical conclusions you come to, you've got to change your personal relationship to time in order to get the benefits of this stuff.
Have you taken up meditation?
I have meditated for about 30 years since I graduated from Amherst. So I'm not a Buddhist, but I do meditate, yes.
Because of other philosophers, like maybe Descartes, who wrote the Meditations,
yes,
you might be led to believe that, you know, some philosophers think of their work as being meditation of some fashion.
Yes.
And that maybe there's another component to being a philosopher than just
absolutely
arguments. And I'm wondering if you could draw a clear distinction between the other parts of being a philosopher and the process of meditation.
Right. Well, first of all, the distinction is not as stark as I drew it. I mean, first of all, in the Buddhist tradition, there are the arguments, too. There's a whole metaphysical literature that includes many arguments similar to the things that you might find in Parfit or any of these contemporary philosophers. And as I understand it, some forms of Buddhist meditation are meditating on the arguments. Now, there are forms of meditation that aren't that. So that would be a kind of combination of the philosophy and the meditation. Now, there have been traditions in Western philosophy that are more like this than our philosophy today. So, for example, the Stoics in the ancient world believed that there was such a thing as a sage. And the sage had not just read the right books and studied the right arguments, but had managed to bring the truths into his life in some fuller way than some of his students might have done, no matter how well they understood the books they read. And this is one of the things now, my own sense is that side of philosophy has tended to fall away. And it's partly through the academic professionalization of philosophy that we study the arguments, but we don't talk about incorporating the truths into our lives in deeper ways. And I'm actually interested in, you know, why we did that and whether it was such a good idea, whether we shouldn't be trying to recapture some of the Stoic sense of living your philosophy as well as just reading it.
I was wondering about the difference between space and time.
Yes.
So that you have parts in space
but it also seems like you can move in space. Because if you move to the other side
yes.
of the room, you would say
that's right.
you have a different
yes.
a different part.
Yeah, but only Billy Pilgrim can move in time, yes.
Right.
Well, there are certainly differences. You are constrained in space. You're constrained by the constraints of locality. I mean, in order to get over there, you have to occupy all the intervening places. It has to do with probably the relation between time and causation. Causation goes from past to future. One of the things that makes time travel so difficult is that it would require backwards causation. It would require your departure at a later time to be a cause of your arrival at an earlier time. It's because causation is stuck going forward in time that's a problem. But causation is also a problem. I mean, causation is one of the reasons why you have to occupy all the intervening spaces in order to get over there. So in some way, the constraints are similar, but they're not exactly the same.
Spencer.
What you just said, interesting, because it seemed like you, eternalism
yes.
has to treat causation as something separate from time.
No.
If causation is part of your conception of time,
yes.
isn't that something that the doctrine of eternalism misses at that time?
Causation isn't part of time. No, that's right. That's an additional fact. It's an additional fact that later events are caused by earlier events and not by subsequent events. That's true. And that additional fact enables the eternalist to take care of something that would otherwise be missing from his view. Because in the eternalist view, although there are relations of past and future, there's no fact about which direction time goes in. That time goes from the past to the future, not from the future to the past. Because in the eternalist picture, well, there are just earlier things and later things. And in order to ask, well, which way do things go, you'd have to talk about things going. And nothing goes in the eternalist picture. So the way the eternalist can explain why there's this asymmetry between past and future is, he can say, well, the asymmetry is in causation. The asymmetry is past events cause future events, but not vice versa.
I'll open up more widely now, so if you're not a student, you can also ask a question.
I have a following question. So if we have this perduring in time and the future is already there, already exists, then that would mean that whatever would happen in the future is already predetermined. And can you do anything about it?
No, that's a separate issue. The idea that... I see. On certain views of the openness of the future, let me think about this for a minute. I suppose there would be certain views of the openness of the future on which the notion that there is just one future would look too constraining. On these views, there are many possible futures and they're all equally there. That's a separate issue that I'm not talking about. My own view of this is that, actually my own view of this is that the openness of the future is another illusion which can also be explained, although the explanation is different from the one that I gave today. Yeah.
So if the openness of the future is another illusion, isn't there just as well an illusion that I can meditate and change my current self and sort of free myself from this tunnel of time, just an illusion?
No, you can make it the case that you are different in the future from the way you are now. You can't make it the case that you are different in the future from what you were always going to be in the future. That's true.
So what's the point?
But,
if that's what they're going to be in the future.
This is another discussion. But the point is that your decision as to what to do does cause things to be the way they're going to be in the future. And so it does make a difference. It's just not that the difference it makes is that the future is different from what it was going to be.
Well, there's so many interesting things that came up. Interesting to me anyhow, and not just then, but now too. But
yes,
right. Let me just try one for starters. There seem to be two important planks of the structure of the paper as it shaped up. One was this attack on endurantist conception, certainly for the self, that
yes.
The self doesn't persist by enduring through time. And then following on with to that was holding a vigorous form of eternalism against some other views of time which might take passage seriously. And I was wondering, so suppose, and now I realize that at the end, especially in your response to some of the previous questions, you said, well, you weren't sure what the philosophical arguments could possibly accomplish as far as changing our relation to time. And so,
right.
But still on the philosophy side, I was wondering really what the importance of those two components were. So suppose somebody bypassed the attack on endurantism.
Yes.
Focused in the philosophy of time literature and said,
yes.
You know, passage is nonsense.
Yes.
Eternalism is the right way to
yes.
go. And whether that would be sufficient, then, if anything would be philosophically sufficient to give you the philosophical lessons you needed as the springboard for this freedom from suffering. In other words, how crucial is the attack on endurantism? Because it seemed at certain points that maybe just giving up passage was enough and that you might not need to take sides on endurantism.
Well, but this is a recipe for... The question is, philosophically, you can come to the conclusion that... that eternalism is the right story about time, and that the intuition that it leaves something out is wrong, and that the experience of the world as containing something that's not captured by the eternalist, that experience is an illusion. But the question is, how do you get the illusion to go away?
Right.
And this is a recipe for how to get the illusion to go away. And the recipe is, the illusion comes from experiencing yourself as enduring, because that's why time seems to pass, because it seems to pass by or go past this enduring me. And if you want to get it to stop seeming to rush past you, you have to stop seeming to yourself to be an enduring you.
So it's a sort of the first part has a kind of therapeutic.
The whole thing is meant to be, yes.
Right, but I guess the thing is that, but suppose somebody...
I'm going to hang out a shingle.
Yeah.
And then you'll have to pay me money for this. Okay, go ahead.
You know, if you've got a saffron robe, I'll but I see, so if somehow, you had a story about how it is that belief in an enduring self, as opposed to a perduring self, or
yes.
whatever the alternatives might be, that a belief in the enduring self fosters or contributes to the illusion of passage. So we might, just by focusing on the philosophy of time, come to believe that there is
yes.
a passage. But then we would lack a certain therapy. We wouldn't lack any philosophical understanding, but therapeutic tool.
That's part of it. But we'd lack something else too. And that is, if you're going to claim that something is an illusion, and if it's something mm-hmm. as deeply entrenched in our experience as the passage of time, you better have a story to tell about where this illusion comes from. I mean, why does time seem to pass if eternalism is all there is to the facts about time? And, I mean, I kind of think in order to make that claim plausible, you have to have an error theory. You have to have an explanation for why it seems to pass if it doesn't really. And so this is an attempt to give an explanation that would reconcile you. I mean, in a way, you know, I've always been really troubled by the philosophy of time, because at Michigan I had this colleague, Larry Sklar, who studies space and time, and he would just say, no, eternalism, it's all there is, earlier, later, closer, further, that's it, that's all there is to time. And I'd say, no, you're crazy. I mean, there's a fact about when now is, and it keeps getting later. And what are you talking about? So I kind of need an explanation before I'm willing to give that up as to why I should give it up.
Delaney.
I liked your paper very much. I was wondering, though, whether stopping the passage of time is going to solve the problem of suffering.
Yes.
And I'm thinking about the following. I give up I believe in this notion of sort of moment to moment.
Yes.
So you give up an enduring self, you accept the notion of a momentary self. And I'm thinking of certain sort of existential experiences, like grief, say.
Yes.
I could imagine a momentary self. You know, you wake up in the morning, say you've lost somebody, and you say, not here, and you have an experience of sorrow.
Yes.
Wake up the next morning, momentary self.
Yes.
You can imagine an individual who does not have a strong, enduring sense of self. But there is that momentary self. And it seems to me that if you're going to grant a momentary self, to the extent there is even that self, you are going to have suffering.
Yes.
And so I think that there's some. I also think there's something more to the Buddhist idea.
Yes.
About what you need that might be a little more radical than what you're conceiving.
I am quite prepared to believe that.
I'll ask you about that. That is whether the.
I don't think of the. So the way I imagined it is. Not that giving up the enduring self means that all unhappiness goes away. The way I was imagining it is that there is a particular kind of suffering, a particular kind of existential anxiety, as it's put in that passage that I quoted, which is attributable to a belief specifically in the endurance of the self. And so I'm looking for that connection. Now, I am fully prepared to believe that there are other kinds of suffering that are due to a belief in even the momentary self. And these would then not be the kind of anxiety about impermanence that I was talking about.
But they could be pretty robust states of suffering.
Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely. And I mean, again, I can only repeat what I said at the beginning, and that is, I'm not a scholar of Buddhism. The scholar of Buddhism is sitting next to you, and I mean, you know, I'm not really pretending to give a full account of the Buddhist conception of suffering and the Buddhist conception of the self and how they're connected. I'm trying to see how to reconstruct one piece that, in a way that can make sense to a Western analytic philosopher who's read Parfit.
Jill?
I'm wondering about the consolation that you are offering.
Yes.
You said that from an eternalist perspective, impermanence consists merely in not being present at all times.
Yes.
Which seems like nothing to worry about.
Yes.
And I'm wondering whether...
I mean, being permanent almost is a kind of temporal obesity. and you kind of think, well, I don't want to be everywhere, right? I like being slim, and so why not be temporally slim as well?
I'm wondering whether the loss of a worry is based on a kind of equivocation that seems to often be involved in temporal terms that are used when describing eternalism. And I was struck by Billy Pilgrim.
Yes.
And he first describes it. He says, when a person dies, he only appears to die. He is still very much alive in the past.
Right.
So it's very silly for people to cry at his funeral. All moments, past, present, and future, always have existed, always will exist. And so you think, okay, well, that time is always there. So I'm just not filling it all up, but I'm still always, there's a kind of...
The way that Vonnegut expresses it is, of course, very confused. I tried to pinpoint one of the confusions, which is that the different visits to different times come in a meta time. But this is another one. It's not the case that all times always exist, because the past doesn't exist now. It existed then. And so you would need to say it differently. I don't particularly see... Look, it's not part of the view that all regret about death goes away. There are certain ways of lamenting mortality that remain. In particular, you can still lament your life's being too short or someone's life's being too short because it's just not big enough. Then you might think, well, a good life needs to be longer than that. So the only thing that gets dispelled is the sense of running out of time, of impending death. Again, as Nalini said, I could still regret that I won't live to see my great-grandchildren. Okay, I could regret that my life is not going to extend to a time when I and my great-grandchildren would meet. That's still available and is still a potential source of unhappiness or suffering. It's the anxiety of running out of time is the only thing that gets addressed. And Billy Pilgrim tries to make it sound as if you get more consolation than that. And you're right in that. He's confused. Sorry, go ahead.
In that same vein, I wondered whether is the consolation meant to be enduring while the recipient of the consolation is not? And the prophet is not confident that he's going to endure, is he confident that others will endure, however, that will receive the consolation? I was trying to figure out, of course, what the moral upshot of this was, and you seem to have those caverns. So I take it you're not applying the question that if you appeared
yes.
in the registrar's office, you could be the proper claimant for that transcript.
Yes.
Of that young man we knew in the class of 74.
Yes.
And to say
I would shudder to look at it, but yes.
Okay. And you'd be the same one who wrote the thesis.
I didn't, no.
Okay. Or that we got Gibbler alive, we could...
Yes.
The same person, no, all that. And for the momentary stuff, the one gets up and says, I live in the moment... I no longer want this wife I had in my former self.
No.
You're not saying that.
No. But now you have to transpose all of those things into statements about interconnected selves. That is to say, there's no denying that my present self and my 19-year-old self are connected in certain intimate ways in which they're not connected to other people. And so you have to transpose all sorts of things about responsibility for past acts, plans for future acts, commitments, debts, and so on, into statements about how different parts, different temporal parts of a single perduring person can be responsible for. Basically, the right hand has to be responsible for what the left hand does. That is to say, the later self has to be responsible for what the earlier self did, given that they're parts of the same person and are connected in the right ways. And now you have to explain how the connections between them ground something like responsibility. But you're going to have to do that anyway.
So, what would be the most important moral upshot, you think, would arise from this kind of...
I don't think that there's any moral. Parfit thinks that there's a moral upshot, because Parfit thinks that what this view does is to attenuate your sense of your connection to yourself through time and make it less distinct from your conception of your connection to other people, so that self-interest becomes less rational in relation to concern for other people, because your future selves are more like others than they previously seemed. I don't buy that, because I think, well, yes, your future selves are other selves, but they're other selves, and we can explain how your present self is connected to them in all kinds of ways that it's not connected to other people. And so we can still explain why self-interest makes a certain kind of sense that interest in others might not.
Quite right. I remember Father Stanley Yockey delivering a lecture years ago at Georgetown. I came up and I said, Father, I gather you're reserved about Immanuel Kant. Oh, that Immanuel Kant. Liberation theology, he knows I'm coming. And he knows what I'm going to say to him when I get there. I remember told this to Dan Robinson. He said, he thinks Kant has to figure out what he's going to say when Yockey gets there. There's a certain consolation in that perspective on life, right? And I was wondering, plant the question you'd address later, how would why would the scheme you put forth be and offer a superior consolation to that traditional Christian consolation?
Not sure. I'm not sure I understand the other... You mean the consolation of immortality?
Yes, I'll see him again. Kant knows I'm coming.
Well, I tell you, when I have thought about the consolations of immortality, meeting Immanuel Kant was not foremost in my thoughts.
That would give you second
thoughts. That would give me second thoughts. And I consider myself a Kantian in ethics. Sorry, Nishi.
Thank you, James.
When I'm under the illusion, which I am, I don't think that what I desire is temporal obesity.
Yes?
I don't want to occupy all the places of time. I have no interest or anxiety about all the occupying any of the points of time that occurred before I was born.
Yes.
For example.
Okay.
And I seem to be equally disinterested in occupying a point of time 2 million years from now. You know, and all the points of time. And a lot of the points of time between now and then, and all the points of time after that. So I wonder if the analogy really works. The anxiety is not an anxiety about, oh, I can't occupy at all. When I think about what makes me anxious, it's that there's a last point in time, and I don't know where it is.
Oh, well, that's, yes.
And that's a bit different than a desire to occupy all the points in time.
Right, but that's a different anxiety, and it's to be solved by consulting the fates, who know when the thread is going to be snipped. That's a different issue. Actually, I've never heard anyone say that that's the source of their anxiety about death. I mean, there is this... Look, I agree that the things that I said about permanence being temporal ubiquity are a little bit too flip, because you also have to account for. I'm digressing a bit from your question, but there's not just the fact that my life is a finite extent; it's that my current self is located closer to the end than to the beginning. So you can, I mean, it seems to me that even on the perdurance view of the self, your present self could, it's kind of like being unhappy about your seat in a theater. You know, that, you know, well, I get to see the show, but I'm not sitting where I want to be. I'd rather be sitting over there. And you can imagine your present self kind of thinking, well, I'm looking at my life from 53 years old. I'd rather be looking at it from 24 years old. You know, I want that seat. And I think even the perdurance view would allow for that kind of perspective envy, right? Because each of your momentary selves is in its own temporal perspective and could be unhappy about the perspective it's got.
This may be a separate anxiety. It might be the same, I'm not sure. But sticking with the spatial analogy, I was thinking that what bothers me is that I have orders. Not that I don't occupy all the points in time.
Yeah.
Right. But that there's an edge.
That, no. You mean you'd like it to be? You mean you'd like it to be vague? You'd like to fade out, kind of vaguely? Is it the sharpness of the edges?
I'm not sure, but the thought that there are points.
I mean,
in
fact, actually, I think, on the perdurance view, I think it probably is vague. That is, I think you probably will fade out. But
I don't think we often think of it.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Let's take one more question, and then we have a reception outside with food and drinks where people can...
Could I just say to this student who asked the first question, I need to answer your question better. So you come to the... So I want to talk to you afterwards if you come to the reception.
All right. There we go. One last question.
This might seem like a little bit of a silly question, but during the talk you used the analogy... the spatial analogy,
yes.
Often, especially in comparing to the endurance view,
yes.
Of the, you know, the occupying all spaces in
yes.
body at once or something like that.
Right.
So then, I then thought about the takeaway of the talk, which was just to be flip about it, live in the moment,
yes.
Be in the moment.
Yeah, no, that's what I said.
That's the temporal.
Yes.
And then I started thinking maybe about this spatial analogy in that moral, and is
yes.
there one?
No.
I mean,
no.
So then, does that bother that the analogy breaks down?
No, because
on the negative argument and not in the positive.
Right. I think it's. I think that we are very present oriented. So, I think that we. That when I say me, what I'm thinking of is me now. And that it actually takes a sort of act of philosophical imagination to sort of remind myself that I am not just me now, but that I am this perduring thing. So I think we tend to think of ourselves as momentary selves anyway. And that this image of the restaurant at the end of the universe that I give at the end let me see if I can say this briefly. The idea is that on the one hand we think of ourselves as momentary subjects, And yet we're constantly trying to transcend that. We're constantly trying to relive the past and prelive the future and be more than just my present self. And in a way, the moral of the story is supposed to be, you know, be what you are. You are a momentary subject, be a momentary subject. Stop trying to take possession of your future and your past and just be the momentary subject you are. That's the idea. So no, I'm not, but it's not the case that you are just your left fingertip.
So let's thank David for a wonderful paper. This will now publish. So the reception is right outside here.